Hello and welcome to this new edition of IFM Lifestyle. I am Christine. In today's program, we will again meet with someone who perfectly combines his interest with his career.
Well, this trip is partly sort of almost holiday-like. I was looking for snow leopard in Qinghai. I was really, really lucky to see a snow leopard. I had great views of one snow leopard up in Qinghai. It was absolutely magical moment. I've been searching for snow leopard for so many years. I've seen one before, but only for a few seconds. This one I could watch for quite a long time. So it was fantastic, absolutely fantastic. It just appeared out of nowhere. Suddenly it was just sitting there and it was looking at me and I was looking back at it and it was just magical, really.
This is Professor Per Ostrom talking about his recent visit to China. The big cat lover is a world-renowned ornithologist at the Department of Ecology and Genetics, Uppsala University, and the Swedish Species Information Center of the Swedish University of Agricultural Sciences.
I'm doing research on different aspects of birds, and one of the things that I'm interested in is just basic, it's called taxonomy, so it's just classification of birds. So I try to identify different species and find out how they are related to each other. So that's taxonomy and systematics. So, and then I use DNA sequence data, I use vocalizations, I look at plumages and structures and behaviors, ecology, etc. So I'm trying to really explore the biodiversity, the avian diversity, to see what is there and how are they related to each other. And that also, if I find something new, for example, I need to describe it. If I realize that a certain subspecies should be treated as a species instead, I will publish on that. But I'm also interested in various aspects, other evolutionary biology aspects. So, for example, speciation, how are new species formed? How do they evolve? And things like that. So why are certain areas really hotspot for birds? Why is there many more birds in certain areas than in other areas and things like that.
How your interest in birds was developed? Is a family tradition?
No, it's actually not. And many people have asked me that because I've been interested in birds since I was maybe, I don't know, 5-6 years old. And I really don't know how it started. It's probably something innate. I don't know. Because none of my parents is interested in birds. None of my relatives is interested in birds. But I think I was quite lucky to grow up in an area on the west coast of Sweden where it was right on the coast and we had some nice forest nearby. So I had lots of opportunities to watch birds. And I remember that my parents, they bought a plate with lots of birds on them. So I probably looked at that and thought, well, that's nice. And I really don't know how it started, but I was very, very young, so it feels like I've always been interested in birds all of my life.
Why they're so interesting to you?
They are so, I mean, birds are abundant. You can see birds everywhere, really. In big cities, of course, there's not a lot of birds, but in the countryside, there's birds everywhere, and there's so much variation. The diversity of birds is enormous, and the small birds, the big birds, the colorful birds, the non-colorful birds, there are birds, lots of different shapes, and with lots of different sounds, and behaviors, and there's so much to look at. So I just find them incredibly interesting and fascinating.
Professor Per Ostrom used to think he would become a medical doctor, but his passion on birds gave him a better solution on career path to be an ornithologist.
In general, between 10 and 11,000 bird species are recognized in the world, but I would say the number is certainly underestimated. There are more birds in the world than we realize. And this is not mainly birds that have not yet been discovered, but it's birds that are today treated as subspecies of a particular species. So a single species can have two or more subspecies, which differ slightly in plumage, for example. And many studies have shown that some of these subspecies are very, very distinctive. So once you start studying them using, for example, genetics and studying the vocalizations, you realize that they're very, very distinctive and they should actually be treated as different species. So I would say from that point of view, there are many more species in the world than we currently recognize, because many of the subspecies are actually, they should be treated as different species, but we haven't studied them well enough yet.
Mm. You can see bears probably everywhere, you know, but we don't know too much about their role in the ecosystem, how important they are.
Well, bears are really important in ecosystems, and we may not appreciate that well enough, because if you take, for example, vultures, They feed on dead things. So I was just in Qinghai. I saw there was a dead yak along the road, and there were probably almost 100 vultures feeding on that. And they will get rid of this yak very quickly before it can cause any kind of problem. For example, the number of vultures have decreased enormously in Asia, especially in India, where vultures used to be incredibly common. They've dropped in numbers by more than 99% in just a few decades. And this has caused a lot of other problems. There's lots of dead carcasses lying around that have led to the increase in the number of dogs, which in turn has led to an increase in the prevalence of rabies, which of course has affected people. So birds really are important. And just imagine all the birds that feed on insects. If they were not there, we would have much more problems with insects in, for example, in the agriculture. And some birds are good at pollinating flowers. Some birds are good at moving fruit seeds. They really have very important functions in different ecosystems, birds, but we tend to forget that, and it really is important. So we need to take care of the birds that we have.
So what kind of threats they are facing?
Well, lots of threats, actually. And if we take, for example, shorebirds, birds that breed mainly along the coasts and inland wetlands, there are enormous numbers of shorebirds breeding along the Siberian coast, the Arctic coast, that migrate in winter along the Chinese coast, south to Southeast Asia, and even Australia and New Zealand. And they need to stop somewhere to feed, to build up their fuel reserves. Now, because of the reclamation of land along the coasts and the drainage of wetlands, many of these birds will have enormous problems in finding the necessary food, the food they need for their long journey. So I honestly fear that unless the reclamation of land and the drainage of wetlands can be stopped very soon, lots and lots of shorebirds will probably go extinct within a few decades, and that is a real serious problem. Also, there is a lot of illegal mist netting of birds, which is really, really bad for populations. And hunting and destruction of habitats are really serious threats to birds. And also general deforestation and general monocultures, like huge agricultural areas with just one or two crops, and heavy use of pesticides, that's also not good for birds. So birds are having a hard time, really, and I really hope that it will be possible to give them better protection, and their environments better protection, their habitats better protection, because habitat is really the key to conserving birds. If you conserve the habitats, the birds have a good chance of surviving.
The number of recognized bird species in the world has increased by 20% in the last half century due to improved taxonomic knowledge. By using new methods, especially analysis of DNA and vocalizations, Professor Per Ahlstrom has described five bird species new to science, and one of them is named after him.
There's a warbler named after me, and that's the English name. So Ahlstrom's warbler is the name of this. I actually described this bird. I gave it its scientific name, which is Caesarchus soror. I did not propose an English name, so it was only when the Handbook of the Birds of the World was published some years later, they thought this must have an English name, and they just named it after me, which was very, very nice of them. I feel very humbled about that. But this bird was overlooked because it's so very, very similar to its closest relatives. And what we found was that one species, which was widely distributed throughout the Himalayas, down to northern Vietnam and large parts of central and eastern China. It was considered to be a single species, and we actually, along with some Chinese and German ornithologists, discovered this is actually six different species that look very, very similar, but they've all got different songs. So that's how we first realized this, because we heard that different populations had different songs. And you can actually find up to four of these species breeding on the same mountain, mainly at different altitudes.
Sometimes when you hear they're singing, actually you can't see them. But how could you, you know, identify this as new species just because the sound?
Now, you have to see them well. And actually, this particular bird, I think it took us 12 years to realize that this is a new species, and we had to sort out. So I think I visited probably 15 different museums in several different countries to look at all their holdings of these birds, and lots of different field trips to Himalayas, different parts of China, northern Vietnam, Myanmar, lots of different places just to study these birds. So it was a lot of work, but during this period I also saw lots of other things. It was not 100% focused on these birds, but on many of these trips those birds were the main focus. But then of course I found other things as well. All those new birds have taken me to exciting places, and yeah, it's been wonderful all the time. Mm. Well, I shouldn't say all the time, because sometimes it's been really, really hard. Sometimes I've cursed myself for being totally wet, or carrying too much equipment, or not getting enough food or sleep. Or but anyway, it's been fun all the time. I just love being out in nature. There's so much fun. I don't understand why is not everybody interested in nature. There's so much to look at. It's so fascinating. It's so marvelous. And anything really, I mean, not only birds, insects, plants, everything in nature is just unbelievably fascinating.
For example, there's a new species.
Yeah.
And how you will give the name to it?
When you describe a new species of bird or animal, you are free to give it any name you want to, provided you follow certain rules.
What's the rules for a bird?
Well, you are, for example, the name has to be Latin or Latinized. You've got to be sure that there is no previous name described for this particular bird. Of course, that's the first thing you need to know. You don't name a bird or a mammal after yourself. You can name it after your wife or your kids or your uncle or somebody else. I've actually, two of the species I've described, I've named after people. So the first one I named after China's most famous ornithologist, Cheng Chaoshen, who I was very lucky to meet in the early 1980s. I met him a few times here in Beijing. He's the grand old man of ornithology in China. And when we discovered this Sichuan bush warbler some years ago, we decided we want to honor him and name this bird after him. And then a few years later, we discovered a thrush, which occurs in the Himalayas and neighboring parts of China. We decided we wanted to honor India's greatest ornithologist, Salim Ali. So we called this bird Suathera Salim Ali, named after him.
How can this name be well recognized?
Yeah, well, you need to publish a name. So you need to write a scientific description of the bird, and you have to follow certain rules when you do that. And once it's published in a scientific journal, it's up to the scientific community to decide whether, yeah, this is okay or not. And maybe somebody will find that, no, this has already been described before. Or maybe somebody will say that, no, I don't think this should be treated as a species. I think it's more likely to be a subspecies of something else. If everybody agrees, then the name will be available for ornithology, and it will be published in field guides and in handbooks and in checklists, etc. So that's how it works. So there is no committee that decides this is right or wrong.
Professor Per Alstrom has traveled extensively across China since 1984 and established close ties with several scientific institutions in China and neighboring countries. quite far away. Flew from Sweden to China. Direct flight back then. So why someone in a European country suddenly have the idea to come to China for bird?
Yeah, that's a good question. Sometimes birds migrate in the wrong direction, so they turn up in the wrong place. So there's a lot of birds that breed in, for example, in eastern Siberia and the winter in Southeast Asia, but sometimes some of these, a few individuals, they will migrate in exactly the wrong direction. So they sometimes turn up in Europe, including Sweden. And after I'd seen all the breeding birds in Sweden, I became interested in those rare ones that rarely would turn up in Sweden, in Europe. I thought in order to learn more about those birds, I should go to where they are common. So I started traveling to Asia in 1982. I first went to India, Nepal, Thailand, Malaysia, etc. Lots of different countries. I was traveling for 8 months with a friend. And then in 84, we decided to go to China, and we started in Hong Kong. And then we went on a murderous train ride from Hong Kong to Fuzhou, which took 45 hours in a hard seat, lights on 24 hours a day. Every single man was smoking, and there was loud speakers all the time shouting songs. And yeah, it was really, really tough ride. But eventually we got there and we got out into some nice habitat. So we saw some birds and then we were happy and forgot about the strenuous ride.
At that time, without internet, how do you know where to go?
Yeah, we didn't actually. We just took a chance. So we, on that particular trip, there was one bird called Pallas's reed bunting that we really wanted to see. And we thought it probably winters in reed beds. So we just went to different cities, because in those days there were just a few cities that were open to foreigners. So we went to different cities and we rented bicycles and we would ride around the cities and we would look for reed beds in the hope of finding Pallas's reed bunting. But it was hard work all the time. We didn't know where to go because there'd been nobody before us. So it was just by chance. We just went to places and hoped to find things. And of course, once we came to a town, we would try to investigate about if there were any nature reserve or any nice area with nice forest, etc. And sometimes we were lucky. Like we went to Omeishan in Sichuan province, and we came there in winter first time, and there was a lot of snow. We couldn't get very high up on the mountain, but there were lots of birds in low elevations where there was no snow. It was hard work. It was really hard work.
Back then, I believe only a few people, probably very, very few people, can speak English.
Yes, hardly.
How could you communicate?
Yes.
How could you tell people what you're doing and what you're trying to find?
That was sometimes very, very, very difficult. And I think I've probably been to many, many places in China where they'd never, ever seen a foreigner before, and which has been very exciting to me. But at the same time, sometimes very difficult. And I remember one place, we got off a train in a town. We weren't absolutely sure which town we were in, but we thought we were in a certain town. We got on a bus. We weren't absolutely sure about which bus, but we were hoping that we were on the right bus to a certain place. And while we were sitting there on the bus, suddenly somebody asked us in English from behind what we were doing there, and it turned out to be a guy from the Philippines who was there to visit his father, who came to China as a businessman, I think 40 years earlier, and who never went back to the Philippines. So this Chinese old man, he could ask the bus driver in Chinese, and then he told his son in Tagalog, which is a Filipino language, and then the son told us in English, and we could speak to each other in Swedish. So it was multi-language communication, and we were actually on the right bus, so we were lucky. But it wasn't always that easy. Sometimes I've struggled buying train tickets, for example. I thought I was getting the right ticket, but I actually, when I looked at the ticket and compared the Chinese characters with a map with Chinese characters, I realized, no, this is not the right place. So sometimes it's been hard. Luckily, I've never got totally lost so far.
Good luck. Yeah.
In terms of bird study, is China an important place?
Absolutely, yes. China is important for birds because it's got a huge variety. It's got some species up. It's got several endemic species that occur only in China and nowhere else in the world. And it's really important breeding ground for many species also. And it's an important migration place for birds. Lots of birds that migrate from Siberia will cross through China on their way to their respective winter quarters. So China really is an incredibly important place for birds. And luckily now there is a lot of Chinese ornithologists that are really good at studying birds. So here at the Chinese Academy of Sciences in Beijing, there's a very, very active group under the leadership of Professor Lei Fumin, who is doing wonderful research on birds of China. And there are also several universities across China that are doing excellent research on birds. So China is really developing very fast into a good ornithological research nation.
This kind of their studies has been well accepted or recognized by the global community.
Absolutely, yes. The Chinese ornithologists are good at publishing in high quality international scientific journals. I would say in most fields of science, China is coming very, very strongly. And for me, who's an old friend of China, it's great to see that. If you'd asked me 30 years ago, I would have laughed if you'd suggested that 30 years later, China would be one of the leading nations in some parts of research. I would have just laughed and said, no, that's out of the question. But no.
Yeah, but nowadays, a lot of Chinese people.
Yes, and that is absolutely wonderful, I think. There's so many people today interested in, especially bird photography, actually. Although some of the bird photographers are not very sensitive to the birds, they will prioritize getting good photograph over the safety of the birds. But anyway, it's really great that there are lots of people interested in bird photography and in bird watching, just enjoying birds, and especially many young people, many students, many youngsters are interested in birds and have developed a genuine interest in birds. And I think it's great, it's wonderful, and it's also crucial for the protection of birds. If you can't love something that you don't know anything about. If you don't love something, you will not protect it. So in order to protect birds, you must get a feeling for them. You must really get to know them and enjoy them and love them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you will not care about them.
And if someone, probably a kid or a young student, mm-hmm. would love to follow your example, what kind of suggestion you would give to them?
I would suggest they follow me. They come with me on a trip. I try to bring students on trips. I like to train them in the field, to give them an opportunity to develop an interest and expertise. But otherwise, if that's not possible, I think somebody wants to study birds on his or her own should just do it slowly and carefully, sit down, watch the birds carefully, make notes, maybe draw some sketches, take photographs if you've got, try to get some sound recordings. Look carefully at the birds and just enjoy them. See what they're doing, see how they're behaving, see what they're eating, see what they look like and compare with the bird books. Maybe sometimes the bird books aren't very accurate. Maybe you can find things that can be improved in the bird books. And it's just building up knowledge. It takes time, but it's fun all the time. So
yeah, it's about time and the passion.
Yes, time and passion, exactly.
Thanks, Professor Per Alstrom, for sharing his passion on bird study with us. And also thank you for listening. And please stay tuned for more on Radio Beijing International. I'm Christine. Bye-bye.